Welcome to DivCasts from University of Chicago Divinity School. For more of our podcasts and information about our terms of use, please see our website, divinity.uchicago.edu/podcasts.
Today, so I'm going to get started. I've got a few announcements and then turn things right over to the mentor to introduce our guests. I'm Aaron Hollander. I'm the program coordinator for the Craft of Teaching program in the Divinity School, and I'd like to offer a very warm welcome to our guests from the Alumni Council and from the Baptist Theological Union who are with us today for this Dean's Seminar in Craft of Teaching. For those who don't know, the Craft of Teaching program is the Divinity School's system for cultivating educators, part of the professional development here at the Divinity School, stemming from the conviction that scholars of religion are always educators in the public sphere, in the classroom, and in all walks of their lives. And the Craft of Teaching program is dedicated to providing the skills and providing a forum for conversation around all of those issues. Our flagship program is the quarterly Dean Seminar, in which an illustrious member of the Divinity School alumni returns to Swift Hall with their insights and leads a weekly seminar especially focused on the themes of course design and institutional context, which for the Craft Teaching program are two of our central themes in both educators here. So I have just a couple announcements. Upcoming events are very exciting, and I do hope you can all join us. This coming Monday, also in the common room at 4 p.m., we have a workshop with Martin Marty called Beyond Polarization, Strategies for Public Engagement, in which Professor Marty will lead us in a conversation based on his extensive experience in education beyond the walls of the classroom, beyond the walls of the university. There will be a reception immediately following that workshop hosted by the Marty Center, and I hope you can join us for that. Next Friday, May 1st, there's a full-day colloquium on introducing religion. And this has been something of a running theme in our program over the last several months, actually. And this colloquium is an opportunity for our own faculty. We've been bringing in guests from all over the country, but now our own faculty will have the time to lead us in a workshop on the challenges and objects and texts with which one might begin a study of religion and introduce it to others. Check our website, check our board for other events. There are several arts and teaching events coming up, so those of you who need arts and teaching credit, we have three of them coming up at the end of this quarter, especially our micro-teaching workshop, which is strictly limited attendance, so please do email me if you're interested in the micro-teaching workshop. All further details are on our website. Finally, please do remember to sign in. We're going to need to flip the room very quickly at the end of the session, so I will set up the computer again out in the lobby for those of you who have not yet had a chance to sign in for practice. And with that, I will turn things over to Dean Mitchell to introduce our guest.
So good afternoon, everyone. The governing metaphor of our school, as you know, is the conversation about religion, what it is and why understanding it matters. Conversations require certain measures of introduction. I'm going to introduce our distinguished alumna of the year in just a moment, but I would like to just ask, going around the room, people, each of you, to introduce yourselves very briefly, like one sentence, PhD student in Hebrew Bible, et cetera. But also I want you to know the distinguished guests who are with us here today. So members of the Baptist Theological Union are somehow on the right, and the members of the Alumni Council on the left. You can do your own allegorical interpretation here. So just briefly, Professor Holt, who are you?
John Holt, professor of religion at Bowdoin College. My degree was in history of religions back in 1977.
Michael Kessler, government law at Georgetown University and managing director of the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs.
Ralph Keane, history department and religious studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago, on the West Loop, and a member of the Alumni Council.
Rob Wilson Black, I'm the CEO of Sojourners in Washington, D.C., and Martin Marty, PhD, and board chair of the National Museum of American Religion.
My name is Kelly Gardner, I'm a PhD student in Hebrew Bible.
I'm Professor Jeff Thompson, a PhD student in Islamic Studies.
Jordan Swornick, PhD in Hebrew Bible.
No longer a PhD in philosophy of religion.
He's not a PhD in philosophy of religion. Maybe Tomlinson, PhD in philosophy of religion.
Navajo Maitra, PhD in history of religion.
Daniel Lark, PhD in philosophy of religion.
Ezra Busdin, PhD in history of religion.
I'm Mark
Thompson,
MA
in Hebrew
Bible.
Timothy Gosman, PhD in Islamic studies.
Yaron Renault, PhD in theology and managing editor of Sightings.
Elizabeth Sartell, PhD student in Islamic Studies.
Caroline
Wilman, MA
student in Religious
Studies. Michelle Ferris, PhD student in Religions in America.
Danielle Delano, MA in History of Religions.
Jessica Pruitt, MA in History of Religions.
Jessica Andrus, PhD in History of Judaism.
Allison Gray, PhD student, New Testament, Early Christian Literature.
Larry Greenfield, alum and BTU.
Joan Price, Professor of Religious Studies at Whittier College. Alum and
faithful. Arlene Francis, I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I'm married to Reed.
John Reed, the University of Michigan Law School Emeritus, and BTU Emeritus.
I'm Arthur Francis, also from Ann Arbor, Michigan, a member of the BTU.
I'm Laura Lieber, I'm Religious Studies at Duke University, History of Judaism with Mike Fishbane, and Lori is for a few more weeks my dean.
Shonda Jha, Director of the Oakland Peace Center, ended MPP 2005, and member of the alumni.
Ben Duhom, I am pastor of the Messiah Lutheran Church in McCauley, Illinois, and a member of the Alumni Council.
Brandon Klein, PhD student in Testament.
Maharshi Vyas, MA student in History of Religion /
Theology. Ernest Brooks, an AMRS student focused in ethics, and I'm also a Duke Divinity alum, so my world's a conversion.
Pamela Jones, the Department of Philosophy and Religion, Central Michigan University.
Gary Sparks, hold on, MDiv 2004, PhD in Theology 2012, and I'm currently teaching at George Mason University, Latin American Religions.
My name is Phil George. I teach at the Middle University of San Marcos,
I'm Dale Walker, I'm the Director of Development and Alumni Relations for the Divinity School, and if any of you got a free copy in the last 24 hours, I paid for it.
Bob Gilmore, Associate Dean of Divinity House at the University of Chicago, alum 2005, and
the Joseph Stone, Cashley Felt at Wichita of the others.
Ross Preston, PhD Committee, History of Religion.
I'm Patrick Walker, and I student in philosophy of religion.
Andrew Kunze, PhD student in anthropology, sociology, and religion.
Song Young Kim, PhD student in New Testament.
Sarah Jones Whitehead, PhD student in religious ethics.
Russell Johnson, PhD student in philosophy of religions, and also a Duke Divinity alum.
Elsa Marty, PhD student in theology.
Thank you to everyone, and that's Taryn Wine, Director of Communications in the Divinity School, with the camera in her hand back there. I think everyone has introduced themselves, and as I said to the Alumni Council when we began this morning, it's such a great thing to see the generations of Swift Hall persons converge in this conversation today. This is the first of two events with the Divinity School's Alumna of the Year, Lori L. Patton. There will be a public lecture this afternoon at 4:30 in the third floor lecture hall with a reception to follow down here. I hope to see all of you there as well. I'm going to make this introduction relatively short. I'll do another later this afternoon. But it is a distinguished honor to welcome Lori L. Patton, Dean of Arts and Sciences, and Robert F. Jordan, Professor of Religion and Professor of Cultural Anthropology at Duke University, and President-elect of Middlebury. Professor Dean Patton holds the BA degree from Harvard Radcliffe College, the MA from the University of Chicago Divinity School, and the PhD in History of Religions with distinction. She is the author of multiple works and several really interesting books in progress, but I'll name just the two monographs, Myth as Argument, the Bhagavata as Canonical Commentary, and then Bringing the Gods to Mind, Mantra and Ritual in Early Indian Sacrifice. In addition to being a gifted educator and translator of the Bhagavad Gita and other texts, Dean and Professor Patton has a remarkable career of achievements in academic administration, which are also relevant to our work in the Craft of Teaching program. And this is one of several events on academic administration that we've done this year. As you know, with President Rebecca Chopp of Denver University was here earlier. But just to give you a sense of some of the scope of her work as Dean of Arts and Sciences at Duke, she oversees 35 academic departments and programs in arts and sciences, supervising the work of divisional deans, Dean of Academic Affairs, Senior Associate Deans, coordinating interdisciplinary institutes, in addition to overseeing the development of new curricula in the liberal arts, significant work at the administrative level that impacts education every day at Duke now and into the future. She was also, from 2008 to 2011, director of the Center for Faculty Development and Excellence, part of the Office of the Vice Provost, Office for Academic Affairs at Emory University, which involved, among other things, directing a new university-wide center involving teaching and learning programs and interdisciplinary research seminars. So her breadth of experience as an educator, both in the classroom and in her scholarship and in the work of administration, making institutions work to be places of teaching and learning, is one of the key reasons she is the Alumna of the Year and a great reason to welcome her here for the Dean's Craft of Teaching seminar this spring. You have pre-distributed a seminar, a syllabus entitled On the Very Idea of Comparing Religion, Theoretical Approaches. Dean Patton will introduce our conversation, and then with no further ado, let's welcome Dean Patton.
Thank you so much, Dean Mitchell. And does anyone need a copy of this? There looks like everyone probably some. Yeah. I'm just going to pass more around on either side. So first of all, I was expecting a 10 to 15 person intimate panel. So instead, we have something rather more grand, which is really wonderful. What a delight to see so many people interested in education. And I will further say that I have two people in this room. Three actually, to keep me, or even more, to keep me very honest. Whatever I say about the past at the University of Chicago, there are several teachers and colleagues here who can correct me. And whatever I say about Duke, my colleague and wonderful friend Laura Lieber will correct me. And whatever I say about this class, Anya Mundra was in this very class 2 years ago when he came to be a visiting student in residence at Duke and hang out and talk philosophy of religion with us there. So multiple modes of correction are here, which is also pretty fun. So what I thought I'd do, I'm not sure I got every single one of your names, but as we jump in, I wrote them down, but as we jump in, please do reintroduce yourself if you want to contribute a thought, idea, intervention, whatever we might call those things that we say in seminars. The other thing that I want to do is just say how exciting it is to be part of an ongoing multi-generational conversation on teaching, partly because some things never change, and you need to say them again and again. One definition of good academic administration is if you say the same thing politely for 10 years, and then occasionally it changes. I think that's also very true for teaching. But there are other contexts, and here's something I very much learned at Emory, where we are in a very different space around teaching. We all are reading the literature about attention spans being different, about modes of writing being different, about modes of reading being different. I'm going to be talking about that a little bit this afternoon. And certain questions questions and issues do endure, but on the other hand, they have different configurations as we move forward. So what I did with this syllabus, and what I thought I'd do today is go through the syllabus, talk a little bit about what I found in offering this class, then talk a little bit about the really wonderful case study method that I happened upon that seems to work magic every time I teach the course this way. And then tell you a little bit about the way the class, as I taught this, has gone. I do teach not only a comparison class, but in addition a myth class in this way. And this is a graduate seminar, so very much aware that you could probably, I have done this kind of introduction to method of study religion using the case study method with undergraduates, but they are, I have only used this case study method at elite liberal arts universities and colleges. I used it at Bard when I taught at Bard College from 1991 to 1996. So this case study method seems to have endured in both the undergraduate liberal arts college environment as well as the graduate seminar in religion university environment, but you do have to change it depending on your perspective. And there's nothing terribly unusual about this. It's, you know, unlike most innovations, if you are, as I tend to call myself, an incrementalist with a vision, then you can do a few little tweaks here and there to this basic method that would be intuitively obvious to almost everybody sitting in this room. But it's the tweaks that are interesting and exciting. So we were very exercised in 1986 to 1991 when I was here at Chicago. Many of those moments of being exercised in this room, this very room, about the question of comparison. Was comparison a violent act that destroyed context and therefore destroyed our respect for the other that we were comparing, and in fact, by implication, the respect for ourselves? Was it imperialist? Was it hegemonic? There was a moment of despair that I now think of as greatly instructive, but then was very difficult as a grad student, and that was we were talking about comparison, and it was really clear that for many people to compare at all was a moral failing intellectually. And I remember when someone actually said that, feeling very sad because I love to compare, and we do it all the time, and yet I didn't feel at that point that I had the voice to really speak about it. So it was with some trepidation that I decided I would offer this class at Emory, this graduate seminar at Emory in the early 2000s, when it still was a much more of a raging debate than I think it has become now. And interestingly, I've offered this class every other year since then. And in each case, the class is filled within an hour of it being listed. So I'm thinking, is fascinating. We're not supposed to be doing it, and yet everyone really wants to do it. There's this very interesting doubleness that itself is worthy of addressing intellectually. And many of the students that I interviewed before they actually took the class were somewhat confessional in their speaking with me, that they confess that they secretly compared. They confess that there were times when their roommate, who was a diehard historian, would come and see the book that they were reading, and they would quickly wrap it up in brown paper just to make sure no one saw that they were reading. And so I think it had a sort of oddly therapeutic approach that I would, with boldness in the early 2000s, teach this class. And then over time, as I think people have just turned to other things, Wendy and I were talking about this morning, moved into their spheres of engagement in a way that simply allowed them to have those spheres of engagement, it seems to have had calmed down a little bit, the debate about comparison, partly because I think people are aware of how to do it responsibly, and they might be intuitively aware of how to do it responsibly, but they very much appreciate a class where doing it responsibly makes sense. So the first time I taught in the early 2000s, the debates between the philosophers who wanted to create responsible and exciting comparative philosophical categories, and the historians who felt that commensurability and historical commensurability was a very important intellectual and ethical issue. Those debates were very heated, but good. Over time, I just taught this course 2 years ago, the one that Anna took, there were the same debates, but they were much more affable, and no one particularly minded that the other person lived in that camp. It might have been just the students themselves being more affable. But at any rate, I still find that the fascination and the excitement about comparison is there. But the sense of something very, very important being at stake is also there, but it has become common in general and a more contemplative conversation. So what I do, I'll walk you through the syllabus and then talk a little bit about how we work the case study method, and then we can open it up for conversation. I think that the basic idea for the syllabus is to begin with science studies. If you turn to page 2, you will see that we begin at the first session looking at the sort of great shot across the bow in the severe work hypothesis about incommensurability, and then the scientific debates between Kuhn, Feuerbach, and Putnam on commensurability, comparability, and communicability. And what's important about reading these articles is that we learn that particularly commensurability is a function of measurement, and that's the scientific debate. Can you measure things in the same way? And if so, why? And if not, why not? Comparability really being for scientists a little bit more about juxtaposition, putting two things alongside, and in what context, laboratory context, one does that, or mathematical context. And finally, communicability, about the question of translation across disciplines or scientific contexts. And that already makes people a little bit more relaxed, because they can see that whatever their issue is with comparison could be understood in one of these ways, instead of, you know, comparison more generally something that one has to confess to in secret. And then scientists hang out and talk about this in some really interesting ways. So that tends to put a broader intellectual context on this, which calms everybody down and makes people feel confident in a way that's very nice. And then we move, this is the hardest moment in the class. It's after we're swimming around in this really fun intellectual history and history of science conversations. We then go to van der Leer, who is blazingly, unapologetically, there was no issue about comparison when he was writing. Dutch phenomenology is just an entirely different beast, deeply influenced by Christian sensibilities, European Christian sensibilities. And yet there's these wonderful sort of moments when, of course, we see his chapter on salvation and cringe. On the other hand, we see this wonderful chapter in the middle of the book on power. And everyone thinks, you know, was this the precursor to Foucault? And then, of course, you have to laugh, because after they have Foucault about as opposite as you can get, and yet here they have this really interesting comparative study of power. And this is what we have in previous iterations of the class. I've actually juxtaposed Foucault's work on discipline and punishment and virtually. Moving from there to what I call the middle writing in phenomenology of religion, our intellectual ancestors, if you were, we look at both Iliada and Smith, Iliada's morphology of symbol and W.C. Smith's understanding of faith commitments, both of those intellectual contexts allowing a comparison to be possible. And we talk at this point about the big system and what it means to think about a large system of symbols or a larger system of faith commitments. Then we move from there into the critiques. Many of you are very aware of these, so I don't need to spend a lot of time on these. But J.Z. Smith's classical essay, Talal Asad, which really talks about the idea of religion itself, even ethnography or anthropology of religion, as overly cognitive in nature. And moving into the most hard-hitting critique of Russ McCutcheon. And so you can see in the classes and litmus tests, the people who get most annoyed by van der Leer and the people who get most annoyed by McCutcheon. You know, those are the kind of two poles in a way. And then we move very unapologetically into people who are doing great comparative work today. Nathan Katz has a very interesting recent edited volume on Indo-Judaic studies. He does a section on history, the historical connections, a section on the philosophical formal connections, and a section on politics. And I talked to people about the fact that we have a whole session, a section at the AAR on Hinduisms and Judaisms, where we think about these questions in more detail. We also look at Frank Clooney's now multiple works in comparative theology, as well as Jose Cabazon's work in scholasticism. Theology, comparative theology really is for Clooney a method of reading. Again, I'll be talking about that this afternoon. And Cabazon, he very straightforwardly outlines eight elements that he thinks could comprise the category of scholasticism and tests each case study against those eight elements. Moving into Kimberly Patton and Benjamin Ray's wonderful book, A Magic Still Dwells, in which we look at various smaller micro-studies of what contexts intellectually could make comparison possible, including Ray Sullivan's wonderful shot across about it, the study of American religion is inherently comparative and how we think about that. We then move into further responses in which we think about theoretical moments in a new key. It's not just because Wendy's sitting here, but The Implied Spider is always a favorite because it has so many wonderful tools with which one can think about a new method for comparative work, mini-myths and maxi-myths, telescopes and microscopes. And then looking a little bit in a philosophy of comparative religions that emerged in the 90s and I think is continuing today, really mostly here in Chicago. We then move to things, categories where nobody has as much of a problem with comparison. It's not an obstacle thing. And I should have mentioned in the beginning that I'd say a third to a half of the students, depending on where I'm teaching it, come from comparative literature, anthropology, or history. So it's always interdisciplinary. People love this class because it's an issue in every field, but differently configured. So when we look at cognitive theories of religions could be understood as a new comparative mode. There is no fussing or introspection about the comparative method at all in cognition, and one of the things I get my students to do when we read Saylor and Boyer is have them outline the unconscious, perhaps, comparative moments that each of them make. Then moving to literary theory and cultural studies, it depends on who's in the class. I sometimes do history and comparative history, and sometimes do comparative literary theory. Bruno Latour's wonderful work, We Have Never Been Modern, in which he argues that so many of the debates in contemporary culture today, particularly nature versus culture, are intertwined, like in global warming, so that you can't really separate nature and culture from those debates. Ozone debate is another example, the question of what constitutes a black hole, and so on. And he says, look, if science as a discourse can't be disentangled from culture, nature as a discourse can't be disentangled from culture, then we might look again at the nature of entanglements of those two things comparatively between our culture and past cultures, as well as our culture and other cultures. And so even though he doesn't say it explicitly, it really is an interesting argument through the idea of intellectual hybridity, discourse hybridity, for a new comparative mode. Natalie Maless's book, many people don't know this book, they really should, All the Difference in the World, Postcoloniality, and the Ends of Comparison, argues that we keep forgetting in comparative literature that the European roots of comparison are positivist in nature, and that if we think about literature now and include the postcolonial forms of literature, we can't simply think of comparison as a broader form of inclusivism in literature, but rather make a distinction between what we want to think of as comparable versus what we want to think of as equivalent. And she does a wonderful study of the poet Aimé Césaire and Derek Walcott, saying, yes, these are comparable poets, but they can't be measured, quote unquote, in the same way because of their postcolonial context. So very, very interesting there. And then ending with Masuzawa, a controversial but interesting book, and Kripo, in which there are very interesting critiques of comparison, even in the well-intentioned liberal language of pluralism, as well as an unabashed argument that In the Serpent's Get to Meet, Jeff has also written another book on comparison, which I also have used, in which comparativists are understood as Gnostics. following in a more positive way Greg Wasserstrom's book on religion after religion. So that's the basic way that we move. I am very easygoing about substituting texts, and so students who want to read other things, I am more than happy. The other thing that I love about this course is every single time we have taught this course, everyone always wants to have dinner or lunch and, you know, continue the chat. So Jewish tradition has a wonderful phrase: "Is this an argument for the sake of heaven? Meaning, is it worth having?" And I feel that whenever there is a request for meals during a class, it is an argument for the sake of heaven. I always serve refreshments. I learned that in Chicago. I always serve wine. Everyone just loves that. The course that Anna was in had two or three Muslims in it, and we were taking a course picture for posterity. That was the only time we had to rush to hide the wine so that the Muslim students had shared their picture with their family. They wouldn't be caught. So let me turn now to why I think this works. So we could just have a great course and talk about these issues and jump in and read the text. And I think in Chicago that would work. And I'm sure there are versions of this class still taught today, and it works beautifully because it's in Chicago. But among the many things I realize is that things that work in Chicago don't always intuitively work immediately outside of Chicago. And so it's a very good thing to sort of find ways to invite one to a Chicago method and modus vivendi. And so I have been very inspired by something that I really learned here, and that is this idea of what's your question? What's the one question that you'll never get tired of asking and you'll never know the answer to? And when I train graduate students, I try to get them to be a little less anxious about method and their own projects by distinguishing between the elevator speech that you have to give the professor that you're trying to impress right away versus the question that you live. And if you do, in fact, live that question, you have the beginning of what I call, in a classroom context, a case study. So I ask every single person to bring to the second class their case study. And it tends to be that question, and it tends to be around their dissertation. It could be a chapter of their dissertation. It could be a thing that they still don't know about how they're thinking about their dissertation, whatever it might be. And we have master's students, and that too is usually what they're going to write their master's thesis on. We are very specific in getting people to describe the parameters of that case study. Sometimes the case study that they bring is too big, and other times it's too small. And so we try to get it sort of right in the middle. I'll give you some examples of some case studies. One was looking at a Christian sect that is now a global sect that is particularly interested in recreating the experience of the original Israelites and looking particularly at their textual moves in interpreting the Bible. Right? So doing the whole sect wouldn't work. Doing one specific aspect of that group from one year would be too specific, but the textual moves in interpreting the Bible was a really nice medium-sized case study. I had a wonderful person who was looking at the ways in which Virgil was used in 19th century Romantic poetry, and there was this fabulous moment. He was terrified of Greek. He was a comparative literature person, and I said, so you're going to think about the classics, and you're going to read Virgil as well as both Greek and Latin counterparts in Greek and Latin. And he said, no, I really just want to learn how Virgil was interpreted. And I said, I'm sorry, but you know some Greek and Latin, and so I'm going to ask you to think about those original texts. And he was terrified, but he did it. And so there's a whole range of other case studies that we've looked at, anthropological ones as well as textual ones and literary ones. And so we then have the students present their case studies to each other. And what's great about it is that it does allow students to share their most important issues and concerns with each other. Now, this is one of the things that I should mention. I have never once taught an introductory methods seminar in a doctoral program that wasn't universally hated and resented by the doctoral students in that program. It never works. And so, A, I never do it anymore, because part of the reason is your first year, you're so nervous about who you are, what your intellectual identity is, and then you know, you have to do this other thing, which is to compare your identity with someone else's when you're not even sure you can compare it. You're not even sure what it is yet. And so I think that moving into this other space where your case study is the thing that you will return to every single week and you will share it with the students in the class every single week means that you are on a journey together. Every single student is going to know your case study and know your issues. And that makes a world of difference. Again, it's a small thing, but it makes a world of difference because your own case study is being shared and the issues around you are being shared every time. But you also have a sense and an appreciation for the full dimensionality of somebody else's case study and dissertation work. So that means that every single class, I require a 3 to 4 page paper. Can be long, people have written me 15 pages because they got a B and a bottom, people have written me one, where you apply the one author that we've read to your case study, very straightforwardly. And think about its relevance, think about its irrelevance, think about why it has nothing to do with it, you have to write at it. And this, again, produces a kind of magic, because in the rigor of the application process of the theory, you're beginning to see what the contours of your dissertation or your case study, whatever it might be, project is. And those contours are very, very helpful because they emerge over time in the process of application of the theory. And the other thing that, the reason I think why this works so well is because I am very explicit at the beginning about scholarly manners. And I know that sounds silly, and I was always very worried as a younger professor about the gendered nature of my insistence on civil discourse. Because people say, oh, you just want everything to be personal. Oh, you just want everything, you know, to be nice. And that's gender in a particular way. And I said, no, this is not a fair characterization of what I'm put. So what I say at the beginning, I pass around a thing that says, that talks about civil discourse in the classroom. And I say, if you are absolutely convinced that in the time of the author you could have done better than the author, then you are entitled to be sarcastic and supportive. But if you are not convinced of that, and I surely hope you are not, then you are not entitled to that. That is not allowed in this classroom. I know the signs of scorn. Note-taking, note-passing, eye-rolling, sneering. I know all of them. I know body language. I know all of this. And those are not allowed either. The only purpose for you in critiquing other people's work, and you will be critiquing each other's work every single week, and every single person will be presented every single week, is to be of service to that person. That the purpose of critique is service and service alone. And I will, in fact, correct people if they're being scornful. I don't mind passion at all in the classroom. But the challenge, of course, is respectful passion. And so that's something that people appreciate, and I think at times find challenging, but it does work. Because then every class, we begin with every single person in the class presenting their application of the theory to their case study. And then other people, after they present it, they usually have about 10 minutes, I just invite the critique right away. And I'm unapologetic about the fact that it is critique, but it is always done in service. And I give a list of phrases to use that help people make the discourse more civil. Like, I think your argument would be better if, or have you thought about, you know, sort of silly things in a way. But I think that, again, giving people very pragmatic guidance in terms of how to make this conversation work really, really helps. And I also am very clear at the beginning that I fail at this ideal every single class. I'm disrespectful in a way that I probably shouldn't be. I don't help someone make an argument better in certain ways in a way that I could. So then you take yourself out of the idea of being a perfect paradigm or whatever you're instantiating and just say, look, this is the ideal that we're all striving for. That's basically the way it has worked. Again, each time I've done it in this case study method, it's been magical. Everybody knows each other's case study really well by the end of the class. I've had students in later semesters come up and say, I really miss that case study of so-and-so's. You know, I hope he's still pursuing it, et cetera. And I think that I'll end by saying that the idea was born in part with an interdisciplinary seminar I led at Emory a long time ago. It was on the nature of disciplines. And we decided we would make the entire seminar about the one most embarrassing thing that you hated about your discipline that you brought to the table. And then embarrassment was featured, and then everyone could relax. And I think that's exactly what happens here, is that, you know, you focus on the struggle, you focus on what's imperfect, and you identify with that in everyone's case study. So I'll end there, and we can open up for comment and critique and whatever you all have. Anil, am I speaking truth?
Absolutely.
Good.
Bring back many happy memories.
Yes, wait, I'm trying to remember.
Okay.
Danielle.
Yeah.
Okay, I missed you. Oh, no, there you are. Danielle.
Okay.
Yes.
You said you taught this class with undergraduates?
Yes. And how did that work?
Yeah, just because I come from like a state school,
yes.
And so when we were in like our intro to world religion class, which is obviously different than this,
yeah.
There'd be like 300
right.
people,
right.
Like the little clickers for like
yeah. Yeah,
participation points.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering how
could it scale?
Yeah,
yeah.
Or just even in a regular normal class size, how working with like a type of case study would work with undergraduates
right.
who maybe have like absolutely no idea.
Sure.
Whether.
Yes. So that's a great question, and you unfortunately asked a professor about something about which she is enthusiastic, so you just have to tell me to stop. But I don't think it could work in a 300-person class. The answer is straightforward.
Yeah.
But I do think it could work in the sections, right? If you do have discussion sessions, it could work in a 15-to-20-person class. So this was I've done it as introduction to method in religion, and I've also done it as introduction to religion. The key to this, and I ask for case studies, and undergraduates have a much harder time finding case studies, but you have to be very patient with what they come up with. Because I had one who decided his case study was going to be Dante. And I said, okay, which Dante? You know, why? And then he realized that, you know, one book of Dante might be a good idea. He loved applying Durkheim to Dante. It was, he just got obsessed with Durkheim once he applied Durkheim to Dante. I mean, it's just fabulous. Because also, undergraduates don't know what's weird. They just do these really weird things. And they know. So that was a perfect example. The other poem that's fabulous was a woman whose entire case study, she grew up in a little town in South Carolina, and her case study was why in her Baptist Sunday school, the entire Sunday school curriculum for the fall before Christmas was to discuss and disallow the existence of a Wiccan seminary that had just started in South Carolina nearby. So it was a whole study of witchcraft and, you know, Wiccan, and she said, I they were trying to be appreciative, but they actually wanted to shut down the seminary. So that was her case study. So kids, undergraduates actually bring really wonderful case studies to the course, but you have to be a lot broader in what constitutes case study. Just the idea that something could interest an undergraduate and hold his or her interest for a whole semester is a revelation, right? And so that's the other thing, we have to be broad and patient. But I love those case studies. It allowed me permission to be weird in all sorts of ways. So you have to, I usually take 2 weeks with the undergrads to get them to do a case study. They're also very anxious about whether mine is better than somebody else's. They have that whole performance thing going on. It. Graduate students pretend not to hack. So, and so you have to, you know, help them with that. And then we do the same thing of, you know, introducing. And we don't do as much of the critique. I usually chose five, say, and rotate. If I've got 15 people in the class, I've got five undergrads to present. But here's the thing that I do that's totally different. We do case study, we read the papers every week, we provide comments. But by the way, the comments are ungraded, the papers are ungraded. You cannot pass the course without having a complete set of response papers, but they're not graded. And so then you get to really go on the intellectual journey with the kids, which is great. And I've also taught it as a senior capstone seminar, I should say. So I've done it in all different levels. What I do in the end is have a trial. So Winnie Sullivan's wonderful book, The Impossibility of Religious Freedom. If you don't know it, it's a great book, and some of you are nodding, so it's wonderful. Briefly explained, it's a court case in Boca Raton where the city of Boca Raton wanted to make completely standard all the graves in Boca, according to city ordinance, for aesthetic reasons. And there's a whole part of the grave site which had cherubim and statues of various kinds and Virgin Marys and stones on Jewish graves, and it was a mess. And it was a delightful mess, a multi-religious mess. And the people whose family were buried in those graves sued the city for undue burden on religious freedom. Why did they do this? Because they thought that, you know, putting stones on graves if you're Jewish, or, you know, having a heartbreaking, like having a statue of a child next to your child who died in a car accident so they'd have someone to play with. I mean, just stuff that breaks your heart. They said, no, this is something that we need, and this is a burden on religious freedom to make us take these down. So the court went to trial, Winnie was one of the expert witnesses, and the question, an expert, you may all be asked, this is about the public study, as I already mentioned, you may all be asked to testify in these cases, were these practices around graves essential to the religious identity of the person? Was it essential, if it's for you to put stones on the graves of your ancestors, for you to be a Jew? Was it essential for you to have a statue of the cherubim to mourn your child and to be a Catholic? And the answer, of course, is no. And so I don't tell my students, because the students generally aren't going to go to the library and read the whole book, so I don't tell them the end of the thing. And what I do is create a trial where every single one of them has to be a theorist and defend the idea that this is essential to religious identity on the basis of the theory that they read. And they love it. And when you let them go for it, they all, there was one year where they all came dressed up as the person. So they all got ahead of pipe. They had a big armchair. It was just fabulous. And they were very excited about the whole thing. Malinowski had a Trobriand Islander next year. And so it was really great. And then they have to, in a courtroom, persuade the judges, and then I have the three students who I think would be really good judges to be the judges, that this is a religious thing on the basis of the theory. So they really learn theory in a wonderful way. And then at the end, I tell them that, in fact, the judge rules against the plaintiffs because none of this is essential to the religious identity, which is textually defined by the court and textually defined by experts. That's why Winnie calls her book The Impossibility of Religious Freedom. So you have to set it up so there's some kind of active engagement, like a trial, in order for kids really to internalize it. So that's a very long answer, but it was such a fun class. I have to tell you the whole story.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, could you give some more examples of some of the case studies that the students have brought in?
Sure.
Curious.
You mean the undergrads or the grads?
Either one, actually.
Okay, so I gave you a couple.
Yeah.
You're Ezra.
Daniel.
Okay. So let's see, I'm trying to think of others. In the graduate level, there was a wonderful woman who's actually doing American Japanese Zen Buddhism, but who had always been obsessed with Paul. So she did a case study on Paul's 1 Corinthians, and she'd come to the study of Zen Buddhism through a study of Christianity, but she didn't want to let go of Paul. So that she said it's not my dissertation, is that okay? I said, yeah, absolutely. So that was wonderful. We had another student this was a great case study on, his whole dissertation is in Adam's Peak, the mountain in Sri Lanka that is a wonderful Buddhist pilgrimage site. And he was looking at about four different, a Buddhist, a Christian, a traveler, and a Muslim account of Adam's Peak in Sri Lanka. And those four texts were his case study. And that's going to comprise one chapter in his dissertation of those particular 19th century accounts. Another student did, he's very interested, he's a student of mine, in Pairava, the Hindu deity Pairava, and how difficult it is actually to get a handle on who and what Pairava is. And it's always very disconcerting when you realize that what you remember reading as a graduate student is now understood as a piece of very venerable intellectual history. So that's what happened. David White's early writing on Paedova is something he's obsessed with because he sees it as a great example of this sort of curiosity of Iliadic history. So he did David White on Paedova. Let's see, we did I'm trying to think of others that were there. Oh, we had a wonderful one on the treatment of Mary in the Quran and in the New Testament. So those could give you an example. A more undergraduate examples. One was the fight about the Ten Commandments in the post office, which was particularly relevant for a student in the town. So it goes like that. Yes?
Well, I'm really struck by the way that this is a course about comparison and a course that is allowing the opportunity to speak and apply these methods of comparison, but that it's also a course about introduction to religious studies. So the argument it seems to me that you're making is that religious studies is comparative studies, or that, I mean, to kind of go further, without comparison, there is no religious studies.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, is some vein of pushback against this students saying, well, there is a way of doing religious studies without it being immersed in this kind of comparative outlook, and here's what it looks like.
Oh, absolutely. So Jessica nailed it in a really interesting way. You nailed my MO, which I did not confess to. The MO is, even administrative work, I do by the Zen approach, meaning the indirect approach, which is people don't know what hit them until they're already doing it because you call it something else, right? And so what they're doing, you're absolutely right, is really interesting comparative work. And that tends to be a very interesting and exciting thing for people. People get so into it as a comparison and the question of what constitutes comparison that they suddenly realize that they're in the midst of religious studies or history of religions or however you want to define the field, comparative religion, and happily swimming along, thinking about different kinds of comparisons without worrying about it, right? Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't go so far as to say I argue that the field is constituted by comparison. Here's the big hypocrisy of me. I actually write really obscure articles on late Vedic texts. And I use my comparative method in my interpretive mode. My big dream when I was here in Chicago was to do a great comparison between the idea of poetics and the relationship between the poet and society in India and Ireland. And I never did that. The Calvert Watkins published something much, much smarter and better than I could have ever done, the great Indian pianist, about 20 years later. So I went, oh, cute, because I would have done a bad job. But I think that because my own work is so specialized, but I love the comparative endeavor for how I work interpretively, and I respect people who do the kind of straightforward comparative work that's done, and I think it's so essential to the academy, I can say both things. So that's important. And secondly, when you look at the critiques like J.C. Smith or others, you really do see examples, and I ask students to bring in examples of very specialized historical work, which, by the way, can also be really good comparative work. But the point is, I have no interest, and this is something I learned from Wendy when she talked in the 80s about toolbox methodology. The way I translate that into we now need multiple methods. It's not just a question of, defending your method, although I do ask students to do that. I said, I don't actually care what your method is. I just want you to make a good argument for it. The other thing I push, which I think is epiphenomenal of 2015 in a way that others, maybe earlier, was not, is you're actually mutually interdependent on other methods. And if you don't acknowledge that, then we got a problem. And that's a newer form of argument. Hi,
Michael.
Michael, hi.
So I noted that besides Frank Spinney's work, so this kind of follows up on Jessica's question. If you've had any experiences with graduate students from not in the history of religions or not in some of these areas that are defined by the syllabus, but say, my own field of religious ethics, where up until very recently, it's been comparative work has been woefully under-theorized, and
yes,
it's now kind of trying to catch up, and I'm not sure where it's going, and this syllabus would be really great to see brought into that conversation. Yeah. So have you had experiences of graduate students in particular coming in from, say, ethics or other fields that, that aren't represented here, and having either given up what they aspired to in a, in a comparative project, or thought, well, I really need to kind of step back and do something that's more comparative, but in a smarter way?
Yes. I will give you two examples. I've never had an ethicist in my class, but I had somebody who was close, a historian of Christianity, who was very interested in Kierkegaard. So he's one example. And the other two, one was the closest thing, really, was a comparative law. He was from the law school. And he was just totally fascinated by comparative law, but didn't understand how people, didn't understand the method, because, as you put it, in comparative law, it's very much under-theorized, ironically enough. Mm-hmm. And the other was someone from African Studies, who was an anthropologist, who really was trying to create a new anthropological theory based on Yoruba categories. And she was going to introduce them, had just decided she was going to write her dissertation in English, which was really hard, because she wanted to write it in Yoruba, but she realized that she couldn't, but decided that most of her work was going to be in introducing these comparatives at categories as things that you should use, and that I should use, you know, in my study of South Asia. And that was really, so those two folks are really interesting. In the first case, with comparative law, the big issue for him was, how do I get people, I'm not going to get my law professor or my tort professor to read Van der Leyen. This is just not going to happen, right? So how do I get the principles that I'm learning each class back into comparative law and make the argument from a legal perspective? And most of his case studies were, okay, here's what I get, how do I make the argument from a legal perspective? And that was his obsession. And he went on to do a PhD in legal studies, which I was thrilled about. Yeah. And I think the class helped him decide to do that. Now, in the Africa case, it was very tough and very tedious. It was tedious because there's a certain kind of post-colonial critique that gets really repetitive really fast. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what was happening over and over again. And I kept saying, yes, but could you, you know, I get it that it's sexist, racist, ethnocentric, and it wasn't dismissive. Let's talk about all three of those things. But as I said in the beginning, and as I said in the beginning of this class, it, for its time, here was its newness, et cetera. And she got it, but I realized in the end, as a pedagogue, I had to just let her do that every time. And I thought, oh God, this is going to be a dissertation where it's going to be really interesting material and really boring theoretical treatment. And that always bums a graduate advisor out. But instead, at the end of every single thing where she had to go through the critique, she would come up with these amazing insights based on the language that she was learning that she felt were better comparative categories for the Yoruba material that she was looking at. So I was really proud of her for doing that. So those are the two examples I would give. Hi. There was a hand in the back.
Oh, hi, it's Naive. Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation, and thank you for mentioning the books that you did, the syllabus. I have a question about, I guess, a case study in the form you've seen in your class or as a longer scholarly project. Assuming that a case study takes the form that between the cases there are similarities and differences, theoretical treatment of which shows the importance or salience of them, what do you think the importance of a challenging or counterfactual question in that might be? Like, well, why these two? Or, you know, could I get the same conclusion somewhere else with a different theory? Is that something that's come up in your work? Is that something you see as an important question or comparison?
I think if I understand your question, you're asking two different questions, both of which are equally important. One is, as students are developing case studies, do they, do you work with them to think about comparing X to Y? And the second is, the larger question, and it's a huge one in comparative studies, which is, do you need comparison? Can you do it another way, right? So those are both great questions. I have had students, let's take the Muslim student that I mentioned earlier. She was a recent convert to Islam, and everything about Islam was better, but you have to live with that when you're dealing with, you know, environments in which people are coming to the intellectual study of something that they converted to. And she wanted to do, let's see, what was it? I think it was originally the Bible and the Quran. We worked, you know, down to something, you know, simpler than that. I mean, smaller than that. But in the midst of that, what was important for her was to place the Quran alongside of, well, in this case, treatment of Mary in the Quran and treatment of Mary in the New Testament, so that one was not derivative of the other. Right? So that's about the nature, I think you're asking about the nature of the juxtaposition part. And so, and it was very hard working with him. We spent a lot of private office hours talking about how she didn't have to do a supersessionist comparison just because the Quran was later and used a lot of the same stories, etc. And so there I did become methodologically warranted. I did say, in your mosque or in other parts of your life, you may understand it this way as a fulfillment, but in my class, we need to look at it in a different way. And we need to understand it as historically later, but equivalent. And this is where Natalie Maness's book is so interesting in comparative literature, is she talks a lot about what equivalence is or not. And that's a huge thing that comes up a lot in the comparative seminar, is what does it mean to think of equivalence? The other thing we do when we work on case studies is talk about the various ways that juxtaposition can occur, if you think of comparison as juxtaposition, there are many other ways to think about it, but is it a historical comparison? Is it a formal comparison? Is it an aesthetic comparison? Is it a philosophical comparison, etc.? And is it an instrumental comparison? There are a number of ways that you can think about it, and it's very important for students to understand that they have their own comparative methodology before they even begin. And then the other wonderful question, which I try to feature immediately, which is, you know, why compare? And there are, I think, many answers to it, but two major ones that emerge. One is, through comparison, you get there faster in an interesting way. And secondly, it's this wonderful idea that I think makes a lot of sense. Frank Clooney speaks about it theologically, is having a secondary tradition that keeps you honest. You know, whatever that would be, the comparing. That's a theological commitment, but I think that's true intellectually, too. So are there ways in which dwelling in another tradition, however long, you're training your imagination to do that, it is the way that you come up with new questions. And we talk a lot about, you know, this is something that really emerged in the 90s, and I think is still useful today, which is the provisional comparison. And we talk a lot about the fact that most comparisons, the point of it is to come up with new questions, not to come up with end categories necessarily. And secondly, that they are inherently provisional, which is why the science studies work on comparison is so wonderful, because it has a strong family resemblance to that hypothesis, which has a great deal of intellectual respect in the academy still. So if you think of a comparative provisional comparison, in the same way you think of a hypothesis, you're restoring dignity to that act in a way that, that is very helpful to people. Yes. Wait. Kelly.
Yeah.
There you are.
Yeah. I'm just curious about thinking about this being an undergrad class, but I think it also applies for graduates as well. Do you? And I may have missed the way you construct the class.
Yeah.
But do you find that you need to actually teach the theories? Do students get it? Are they going home reading? and then they apply, they write their thing, they apply, they come in and talk about it. Are they all right on, you know, or do you do a lecture? Do you, you know, do you teach the concepts and have to kind of unpack them first before they can apply it?
Yes.
And again, I would assume it's going to work differently for the undergraduate students versus the graduate students, but, you know, in thinking about teaching, not only teaching what they're saying, and their context, as you've pointed to now a number of times, but also the way to make that application in a responsible way that is going to help their work and, you know, both sides of it.
Yeah. That's a great question, and it reminds me that I forgot to tell you something, which is that at the beginning of every class, I do a lecture.
Okay.
Background and basic ideas. And then I turn to the graduate students who then present the basics of the theory. And so
in an undergrad class or in a
I also do it in an advanced undergrad.
Okay.
In the undergrad class I usually do, we do much more lecture.
Uh-huh.
And then question and you need to get the basics of the theory.
Okay.
But so, you know, if the seminar is 3 hours long,
I see.
The first 15, 20 minutes, usually half an hour, because I love the theories,
yeah.
You know, I would do a background.
I see.
And then two students are asked to present.
Okay.
And then we go into the application of everybody.
Okay.
And so that's, it works so that you do look at basic concepts, master your basic concepts, and so on. And then you have a whole 2 hours. If
uh-huh.
there's like 10 students, you can do this.
Uh-huh.
However, the other thing I will say is there's nothing that tests a student's understanding of a theory better
yeah.
than application, right? So you're going to see where they were just like, whoa, something's wrong here.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't grade them.
Okay.
And so when I give my responses, this is another thing I forgot to tell you that makes the class really fun, is in the responses I do a co-op, which is I give them one question as a response to their, I do lots of comments on the side and so forth, and then whatever the question that I have in my mind based on the response, I put in the form of a hard question, comments, what I call it, sort of playful. And people continue to think about it once they get my response.
Okay.
So it gives you a lot of moments and chances for people to correct
a
clear understanding.
I see.
Yeah.
That's great.
Do you have time for a final question?
Yeah, I really like the idea of a driving, I'm Russell. I really like the idea of a driving question, the one that you can't ever get tired of asking. But I've sort of raised that with other people, and they'll say things like, oh, I don't really know, I just like taking classes, you know, I took these classes, now I take these classes. So as a teacher, what sort of questions, examples, how do you try and get people in touch with what they care about such that they can maybe pick a case study better in touch with their own interests?
So, there's a way to answer that, which is a big educational answer,
okay.
as well as a within the class answer. You want both?
Sure.
All right. So the big educational answer is something that was amazing that happened at Duke, which is I did this exercise with a group of people interested in service learning undergrads at Duke called What's Your Question? And to my immense surprise, it just took off, and people, all the undergraduates, wanted a question. They realized that they couldn't be competitive with each other about who had the better question. And they did a Facebook page, they do events, they do a series of workshops, and so on. And so I think for intensely pre-professional environments, undergraduate, the way that Duke is, it tends to really work because it reconnects students with something that we would call intellectual purpose. I don't know what the undergraduate environment at Chicago is like now. I think it would have been easier for students at Chicago then, undergraduate, to have this exercise, but it's harder in this environment in 2015. So it really helps to just explain it, talk about it, you know, et cetera. And the undergrad questions are going to be much bigger in general than grad questions. The other thing I would say is a lot of times graduate students will say, well, I have this area of interest. I said, well, areas of interest are great, and you can take a lot of classes, but an area of interest is not a question. And I force them to put it in the grammatical, you know, interrogative form, because it does help them
settle into something that will be lifelong. Generally speaking, graduate students are better at formulating questions in a way that, but I think the other side of it for graduate students is they tend to say, and then they tend to write dissertations which complexify, you know, and I say, oh, I want to complexify X, and my argument is that I am complexifying Y. And I have zero patience for that. Don't do that. That's not a question. You know, you can complexify anything. That's way too easy. You know, so I think, and then sometimes when they do that, and that's the usual thing that makes it hard with grad students, I'll say, why? You know, anyone can, I mean, it's good, you have to complexify, but why? And then they're thinking about, you know, what the why is behind the complexification. So that's the route it usually takes.
We need to come to an end, and we need to empty the room briskly and enthusiastically. Another meeting here immediately follows, so please do bring all your belongings and lunchboxes and everything else. And please first join me in thanking the panel.
By Dean Patton, Grandmother Language, A Chicagoan Sojourn with Women, Sanskrit, and the Ethnography of Reading. We'll see you at 4:30.
We thank you for listening to or viewing our podcast. For more information and for other podcasts, please see our website, divinity.uchicago.edu/podcasts. Copyright, the University of Chicago Divinity School.